Welcome to Grid Talk, a series of conversations with the leaders and innovators shaping the 21st century grid. Hosting the podcast is Marty Rosenberg, an award-winning energy journalist. The series is sponsored by the Department of Energy's Office of Electricity Advanced Grid Research Division. Now, here's Marty Rosenberg with Grid Talk.
Hi, and welcome to Grid Talk. Today we have with us Julia Hamm, the CEO and I believe the founder of the Smart Electric Power Alliance. Hi, Julia. How are you?
Hi, Marty. Good to see you. I'm doing well.
So we understand you're undergoing a transition and you're going to be leaving SEPA. So we thought we want to be among the first to conduct an exit interview. How do you find the industry today and what excites you about what you've been able to accomplish at SEPA in the last two decades?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, it has been a long time. You know, I first started working with the organization all the way back in the 90s, in 1999, when, at that point in time, the organization was focused on solar and photovoltaic specifically before there even really was a grid connected solar market in the US. So in those early days, we were focused on helping develop that market and really jumpstart things through a public-private partnership with the Department of Energy that helped fund the first 1,100 grid-connected PV systems, and specifically working with electric utilities to help them learn about the technology and the various applications that it would likely have in the future as part of the energy system. And it's just been amazing to watch what's happened over the course of those two decades since then, more than two decades since then. You know, with SEPA, you know, being focused so largely, again, originally in the solar space, but really in the past 7 to 8 years, much more broadly on everything related to decarbonization as it relates to the power sector. You know, I think the biggest transformation that, you know, has been most exciting for me to watch is the mindset of the electric utility space specifically. You know, and really, in those early years, dabbling in renewable energy technologies, you know, thinking about what options might be available for their customers, but really, you know, not having clean energy and climate change as a core part of the business. And that really is totally the opposite of what the case is today, where electric utilities consider clean energy a core part of their mission. And it is not just a core part of their mission, but utilities are now playing an active leadership role in helping to decarbonize not only their own business operations, but also working proactively with customers, others in their supply chain, and really across the whole economy in order to accelerate decarbonization.
How ubiquitous would you say that is? Is it just a quarter of all utilities? Is it the largest? Where does this change of culture reside?
Yeah, it's a great question. So anyone who's really familiar with the U.S. utility industry knows that there are a lot of electric utilities. There's over 3,000 electric utilities in the U.S. Many of those are very small rural electric co-ops or municipal utilities. So when we talk about the numbers, it's sort of hard to say, okay, how many of those 3,000 plus are really at this point of taking a leadership role. But what I think a good data point to really show where we are in this transformation is that as of today, 73% of all U.S. electric customers are served by a utility that has a public target for 100% carbon reduction. So I'd say that, you know, that's pretty significant. You know, 73% of all customers now are served by a utility that is committed to significant carbon reduction in the near term.
As you know, there's been debate in recent weeks triggered by a Supreme Court decision on the extent to which a government agency can lead this transformation. Are you here to tell us it's irrelevant and that the industry is changing on its own regardless?
Well, I'm not going to say anything is ever irrelevant, but I do not believe that it would be the primary driver and this would be happening regardless. You know, federal policy over my, you know, couple of decades of experience, federal policy certainly can help accelerate things, but this is happening with or without federal policy drivers, without federal regulation requiring it to happen. You know, at this point, it really is about the economics, it's about customer expectations, it's about investor expectations, and there are so many more significant drivers that mean that we really are past the tipping point. This is not something any longer that needs to be driven by policy and regulation.
So if you, in the coming weeks, were to sit down with your successor at SEPA, what half dozen or three or four issues would you say that person, he or she, needs to pay most attention to?
Yep, that's a great question. Well, at a really high level, it's an easy question to answer because the way SEPA organizes its work is into what we call three pathways. And those three pathways, the first is regulatory and business innovation. And that's recognizing that, you know, the way that our regulatory structure was designed, you know, more than 100 years ago was in a very different time. Technology was very different. You know, large central station power plants without all of the technologies we have available today. So we need to continue to see an evolution in electric utility regulation that really provides incentive for utilities to do things differently, that allows them to earn revenues in a whole new way, and also that the utilities themselves, their business models need to continue to evolve. So that's sort of this whole first category.
Julia, before you move to two and three, how would you grade state regulators right now? The rap there has been they change jobs so frequently. By the time they develop the expertise they need, they're on to another job. Do they have the depth of bench in state commissions to really do what's needed?
I would say it depends on the state. You know, some states have much larger commission staffs than others. You know, there are some states where they're very well resourced, but those are the exception. I think the way you just articulated it, Marty, is right. You know, most of the state public utility commissions are under-resourced. They, you know, they may have staff members who are around for a long tenure, but the commissioners themselves turn over very quickly. So I think that there really is room for improvement just in terms of some of the, sort of the processes, you know, finding ways. And it is, you know, it's very hard given the pace of change in our industry, especially for commissions that are regulating more than just electricity, right? I mean, in many cases, the commissions are regulating, you know, electricity, they're regulating water, they may be regulating transportation, you know, maybe even other things. And so that's a lot on one regulator's plate to be able to keep pace and really continue to be educated about the changes that are happening with technologies, you know, with new ways of operating the electric grid and planning the electric grid.
So basically, are you saying that the gridlock or the fact that a lot of state commissions are hamstrung is going to make this pathway hard for utilities to negotiate?
Well, I think it always has made it hard, right? And this is not to place blame on the regulators or the commissions themselves, right? This is a resource constraint largely. But I think one of the things that, you know, I know we've spent a lot of time thinking about at SEPA and many other organizations as well, is thinking about what are some of the ways in which we can speed up some of the regulatory processes that historically have taken, you know, potentially even up to 2 years when, you know, if a utility is filing to, you know, do a new project with a relatively new and emerging technology or a new pilot for a customer program. If it takes 2 years to get approval of that, our space is changing so quickly that what was proposed 2 years ago may not even any longer be the thing that the utility may think is best for customers anymore. So really thinking about how do we speed up, and it is, the regulatory process is slow by design. We do need to be thoughtful and make sure that we have all the opportunities for stakeholders to be engaged and provide input. But we need to find that right balance of the due diligence, the stakeholder engagement, and speeding things up to make sure that policy and regulation is actually keeping pace with the change of technology.
Okay, so that was pathway one. What's your next pathway?
Yeah, so the second one, actually, it's a very good transition right into grid integration is the second pathway. And I mentioned a moment ago about you know, needing to change the way we plan and operate our electric grid. So a lot of the grid integration issues that we're dealing with have to do with a lot of those planning functions, a lot of those operating practices, as well as keeping pace, you know, really understanding what the new technologies are that are available to utilities. And also critically important in grid integration is thinking about resilience and really thinking about resilience at a system-wide level. You know, one of the, and this sort of connects the dots on a couple of things that I've just mentioned, but historically, the industry has thought and planned in a very siloed way, for example, between transmission and distribution. We need to think much more holistically and be doing transmission and distribution planning together to really make sure that we're optimizing the system and making the investments in the right way that are going to be best for customers, limit stranded assets in the future, and really be able to optimize the increasing amount of carbon-free resources that are coming onto the system.
So what's that likely to look like in an urban area or a suburban area? Do you see more distributed generation as this grid integration takes place? Is there going to be a radical transformation, a slow transformation? How do you see it playing out?
You know, I hate to use the phrase, but all of the above. I mean, you know, in terms of it, are, you know, is it going to be more distributed energy or more larger scale plants? I think it's going to be a combination. I think in different parts of the country, it's going to look different. The pace of change is going to be different in different parts of the country. You know, we've seen that very clearly, you know, with rooftop solar. We've seen it with battery storage. We've seen it with electric vehicles. Different states and even within a single state, different parts of the state, the pace of adoption of new technology can be drastically different. And that actually is one of the things that utilities often are most challenged by, is that now with all of these new technologies, they actually need to be able to become experts at forecasting consumer behavior and being able to forecast which customers, all the way down to a neighborhood level, down to a feeder level, you know, which customers are most likely to adopt what technologies when, because that has a drastic implication on what investments the utility should be making in the distribution system. So that's this whole new area for utilities, you know, to, it's not a skill set that historically they have needed to have. You know, when we had, you know, large central station power plants and the power was just delivered to the customer one way, end of story. You know, it was largely a single decision maker in the process. And now every customer is also a decision maker that's doing things that have direct implications on the system.
So if it's timely, inject here the whole discussion of electrification of transportation.
Well, conveniently, Marty, that is our third pathway, electrification.
Okay, let's go.
Yeah, no, perfect segue, because our third pathway is electrification. And obviously, I should go without saying, you know, the three pathways we have, there is significant crossover and intersection between all three of them. But we have still found it a useful way to organize our thinking and our work. So electrification is the third pathway. You know, we're currently focused, the majority of our effort at this point in time is focused on transportation. However, increasingly also beginning to focus on the building side of things, and really beginning to think about what role do utilities have in building electrification in addition to transportation electrification. And there's just so much happening, particularly in the transportation electrification space. But one of the things that we're increasingly spending our time on, which ties back into the grid integration pathway, is around planning and really beginning to help the industry think about what conversations need to be happening when particularly with fleet owners, about when they plan to electrify their fleets in order for utilities to be able to get the grid ready and ultimately not be in a situation where companies that have large fleets of vehicles decide to electrify them but haven't communicated with the utility early enough in the process so that once those vehicles show up, the grid in some cases, if that communication hasn't happened, the grid may not be ready to be able to accommodate all of that charging. So we're really starting to spend a lot more time thinking about what is the planning process need to look like when it comes to fleet electrification, and what is the role for utilities to be playing in that?
So planning by who? Would it be state regulators? Would it be FERC? Would it be utilities? Or are you going to say all of the above?
All of the above. Yeah.
You're being at this beginning to sound like Tom Fanning.
It really is true. Not just with electrification, but with everything that's part of the electric system, we need to see an increased level of coordination at the federal, state, and local levels, far beyond what we have historically seen.
So, who's going to initiate that? I mean, who has that picture? And is there anybody driving that transformation?
Well, I don't know that it's going to be any one entity. I think that, you know, a lot of players in the space need to be part of that conversation. You know, certainly I think that is an important role that increasingly SEPA can help play, because our membership is so broad and does operate at all three of those levels that I think there's an important role that we can play. But there are certainly many other organizations as well. I don't think one organization or one government agency can cover the breadth, of what needs to be done to make sure that that coordination is happening appropriately at all three levels.
So if President Biden and the Speaker of the House and the head of the Senate called you and said, what piece of legislation would you like? What would legislation need to look like to get this coordination rolling? Because we're talking about auto manufacturers that have already targeted dates when they're not be making fuel-powered cars anymore, fossil fuel-powered cars. This is coming fairly fast. Is there any legislation that you see? Do you see an agency being created to spearhead this?
You know, Marty, I'm actually going to take a pass on answering that, because legislation is not a place that SEPA has historically focused its efforts. I just am not personally the best person to speak to what the optimal legislation would look like to accomplish that.
Okay. So as you look at these three buckets, do you think that the industry as well as SEPA is at some kind of crossroads and it's going to be marching in a different direction fairly fast?
I think we already are. I don't think it's a matter of there is now going to be some big shift. I personally, again, sort of having the perspective on looking back over the past almost now 2.5 decades, to me, it feels as though that shift happened in the 2019 timeframe. You know, that's really when we began to see the big wave of utility commitments to decarbonization happen, and the pace has been picking up steadily ever since then. But to me, that, you know, late 2018, early 2019 was the tipping point where I felt like the real shift happened, and now we're in execution mode. We're no longer in the mode of needing to convince people that this needs to happen. We are in the mode of figuring out how do we get this done, and it's not going to be easy.
So if I'm reading the clippings correctly, you started as president and CEO of SEPA, you were 27. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, if anyone wants to do the math, I started as the CEO in 2004 at 27. I actually had started working there in 1999 when I was even younger than that. But yes, I've been running the organization since I was 27.
So my question is, in the subsequent two and a half decades, You've changed. You've met lots of different folks across the industry. Full disclosure, I had the benefit of being on a trip to Japan where we studied solar power deployments in Japan as a media representative. What kind of How do you process your sense of this network of folks that you've developed? And what do you personally feel about the journey you've been through the last 2.5 decades?
Oh, gosh. You're going to make me think hard and long here, Marty. You know, honestly, it is, I think the network of people, the network that I've built is probably the thing that excites me the most, right? It's the thing that has made me wake up every day and be excited to go to work. I love connect in particular because I love connecting people and ideas. So nothing sort of makes me feel more accomplished than a day when I have a conversation with somebody and they say something to me and I can say, oh my gosh, like, do you know so-and-so? Because I was just talking to them and they're having the same problem, or they dealt with that same problem 18 months ago and they have a really good solution to that. Like, can I connect you with that person? So being able to have such a broad and deep network and be able to connect people with each other is, again, the thing that, you know, I think sort of was one of the most motivating factors for me over the course of the 2 decades running SEPA.
So without doing the math, you're a young woman. What's your next challenge? What do you want to do next?
Well, it's a combination of things. I mean, honestly, it's been an intense 2 decades. I'm ready to slow down. So I'm actually, as you know, speaking to you the day before I move into a new home in Marco Island, Florida. So I plan to spend a whole lot more time not working than I have the past 2 decades. Once I leave, I do expect to still be around at SEPA for a number of months until my replacement is hired and onboarded. But once I do leave, you know, I'm not going to do nothing. I'm not going to go into full retirement. But my plan is to contribute and really continue to address climate change, but in a very different way, and serve on a small handful of corporate boards where I can make a direct contribution to companies that are committed to the same vision and mission, essentially, that SEPA has, but really doing it, you know, through a, you know, a specific product or service that the company is offering.
Let me direct you to two that you're on, have been on, and whether you're going to stay on. You're chair of the Clean Energy and Leadership Institute. What is that, and why do you like being there?
Yeah, so CLI is a nonprofit. It is an amazing organization that is focused on really preparing the next generation of clean energy leaders and making sure that that's done in a diverse, equitable, and inclusive way. So the flagship program of CLI is a fellowship program. And so essentially it's focused on early career professionals who are the best and brightest in our space or looking to enter into our space to really make sure that they have a very sound foundation of knowledge and understanding about all of the different issues. Because essentially the original premise when the organization was founded was, you know, there's lots of people, for example, who were deep experts in solar finance, but they didn't understand how an electric utility worked. Or they were a deep expert in energy storage technology, but they didn't understand how energy storage interplayed with other clean energy resources. So really, the fellowship is designed, the curriculum is designed to make sure that these early career professionals see the big picture and can see how the pieces of the puzzle fit together.
So you also have been on the advisory board for the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, PREPA.
Yep.
They've had a lot of problems rebuilding after the hurricane, and there have been political problems since. What's your involvement there, and how do you see that project evolving?
Yeah, well, so that my involvement is not ongoing. I was involved. I was on the Transformation Advisory Council for the electric utility in Puerto Rico from right after when Hurricane Maria happened in the fourth quarter of 2017. For just about 2 years after that. But I actually it's been 3 or 4 years now since I've been involved. So my involvement has not been ongoing. But I still, of course, watch what's happening. Continues to be a, you know, sort of challenging market to work in, but it is exciting to see the progress that's being made. In particular, as it relates to microgrids in Puerto Rico, you know, it is an it literally is obviously an island, and so they have some unique constraints that states on the mainland don't have in terms of their resources. And so, you know, there are a lot of very rural parts of Puerto Rico where microgrids are a very good solution for them and cost-effective solution. So it's been great to see the microgrid development really beginning to pick up, in addition to a whole variety of other things, you know, large-scale solar development and other large-scale clean energy resources as well.
So 6 months from now, if a headhunter calls you and says, we have a large investor-owned utility in City X that needs somebody with your profile to be CEO, what would you tell them?
Oh, Lord. I would be very flattered and honored to take the call, but I would refer them to some other very qualified people.
Okay.
However, if they need someone who has this phenomenal perspective and network that I have to serve on their board, that would be an immediate yes.
We're going to charge you for that little request. Is there anything you want to tell us in imparting about your career and what you've been thinking the last few days as you told your staff and talked to your husband about what's next?
Yeah, you know, I cannot emphasize enough how not only proud I am of what SEPA has accomplished, but how excited I am about SEPA's future. You know, this is not about, you know, sort of me leaving an organization that sort of reached its peak. And that's not at all what this is about. This is about, you know, this is an organization that has done so much good, has had so much impact, and has the opportunity to really significantly increase the impact even more from here forward. And I am so excited for a new, fresh, energized leader to come in and be able to see, you know, again, I'm so proud of what I've accomplished. I've done amazing things for the organization. But no matter how good a CEO is, after 20 years, you know, it's you're probably missing some things and, you know, that someone else might see that you don't. So I am just so excited for the organization. I will always support the organization in any way I can, be there, you know, to not only be a cheerleader, but to actually help in anything that's needed. But it's, you know, I'm so passionate about the organization and I really am excited about its future. And I just can't wait to see what comes next for SEPA post-Julia.
Okay. Thank you, Julia.
Thank you, Marty.
Thanks for listening to Grid Talk. We've been talking to Julia Hamm, who is stepping down as the CEO of Smart Electric Power Alliance. Please send us your feedback or questions to gridtalk@nrel.gov, and we encourage you to give the podcast a rating or review on your favorite platform. For more information about the series or to subscribe, visit smartgrid.gov.
Thanks for listening to Grid Talk, presented by the U.S. Department of Energy Office of Electricity Advanced Grid Research Division. Subscribe through your favorite podcast provider or visit smartgrid.gov for more information.